All right, Jim, I was going to just start out by asking you where you were born.
Freeport, PA.
You grew up in Freeport?
Yeah.
During the Great Depression?
I was born and raised there. I was born in 1922, you know.
What did your father do for a living?
He worked on the railroad. Started out as a tower operator, keeping trains moving and so on. And he used to take me to work with him. He worked his way up to where he became a train dispatcher out of Pittsburgh, building trains at Union Station to send Harrisburg, Philadelphia, you know, wherever.
Was he able to keep his job through the Depression?
Oh, yeah. But you know, one thing that they did that always amazed me was that some of the young fellows on the railroad lost their work because they didn't have seniority. So my father and a lot of the older fellows who had seniority would meet at the Eagle Club, and they would give days, certain days a week. Like you give 2 days, I give 2 days. And they'd spread that around to the young fellows who didn't have any work. Imagine them doing that today. Now, people were different then, you know, when I grew up.
What kind of a kid were you?
Oh, I was never in any trouble, you know. I liked to work in the garden. We had a big garden in the back of the house, and I would cut grass for old maids there in Freeport. My mother had friends, you know, who their husbands had died, and I would go and clip things for them, shrubs and hedges, and I liked to work. And my father came down with Bright's disease, kidney disease. And I remember my sister was a registered nurse. She came home from Pittsburgh and was staying with us. And he was upstairs in a bedroom right on the river. And the steamboats would come up with barges with coal, taking him upriver, you know. And I'd say to him, "Dad, there goes the Walcuta, or there goes the J.K. Davidson, you know, I remember the steamboat." And he would take him a while to answer. He was lying there in bed, you know. And finally, I made some comment to him, and he didn't answer me. And I glanced over at him, and his eyes were looking at the ceiling. So I went downstairs and told my sister Grace, "Go up and check Dad." So she came down crying, and I knew he had passed away, you know. But he took me hunting with him and fishing, and I always spent time with him, you know.
When did he die?
I was 14, so he would have died. I was born in 22, so he would have died in 36. And speaking of 36, we were right on the river for the 36 flood. We were at school, and they came to us and told us anybody living in the lower end better head for home. And I remember walking home with water up to my knees on Water Street. So I got home, and the water kept coming. We had 9 feet 3 inches of ceiling height in the home we owned. And that water come up 9 feet in our first floor. We lost everything in the first floor.
Were you the oldest son?
Yeah, I was the oldest son. I had 3 older sisters. And then I had a younger sister and a younger brother. I lost my last sister down in Florida here a couple years ago. She was 93. I'm the last one in the family now, the only one left.
Did you have to go to work, or were you able to continue to go to school?
No, I went to school for a couple of years to a Pittsburgh Engineering Institute, and then my mother was trying to raise my younger brother and sister. So I went for 2 years, and I quit and went to Scaife Company and took a job.
This is before the war?
Yeah. And I graduated from high school in 1940. When I was working, if I needed information on hydraulics, pneumatics, surveying, whatever, Penn State had a satellite school in New Kensington, so I would just sign up for night school there, study a certain subject that I wanted. So I increased my education that way. But when I went to work for Scaife Company, we were boilers, air tanks, and cylinders, propane cylinders, the big tanks you see behind motels, 500,000-gallon tanks. Them in the war broke out, we put a new building in, a nice big building, and we started making mortar shells, bombs, and armor plate for Cadillac Corporation. They were making tanks. So I wouldn't have had to go at all. I could have rode deferments.
So you were exempt from military service?
Yeah, I could have rode deferments the whole time. But all my friends were drafted or volunteered. I'm from a little town, you know, and I really felt guilty. You know, all my buddies going. So I went into our president. I told him I was going to enlist. And he said, "Oh, you don't want to do that." I said, "Yeah, I want to do it." So I went into Pittsburgh and enlisted in the Air Corps.
Why the Air Corps? Why did you choose that?
Well, I loved aviation. I built model airplanes. I had a whole attic full of them. When I left for the Army, every kid in the block knocked on the front door wanting a model airplane. So every kid, I'd give them a model airplane, you know. I built Japanese models, which were tough. I flew flying models, too. I built one, I know what it was. It was a Fokker tri-motor. Had a wingspan, about 3 feet. I was vacationing with my grandmother in Aspinwall. And the fellow who lived next door, a bachelor, worked for Semple Chevrolet. He said, Jim, you ever think about being in the Soapbox Derby? I said, no, because you had to build a little car and all this. You had to have wheels and whatnot. He says, let's build one. So we built a Soapbox Derby racer. And we built it out of a frame and canvas covered, you know. And he got the wheels for it, brought a steering wheel for me. And we raced on Sawmill Run Boulevard in Pittsburgh. I can remember that like it was yesterday. And I didn't win. I came in second. But the fellow who won, the kid who won, his father was the manual training teacher in Atsmall School. You ought to saw his car. It was beautiful, you know. You were supposed to build it yourself. Boy, that thing was beautiful, see? And he won, and he went to Cleveland. I don't know from there what happened. But I got this model of a Fokker tri-motor, and it had an 8-inch hardwood prop on the front of it that propelled it. It was about 3-foot wingspan, and you built it, a skeleton, and you covered it with paper, and it was Japanese, forget what kind of paper they called it. When you built the wings, you had a reed. Well, it was about 3/16 thick. That was the leading edge of your wing. You took a hot needle, you burned holes in that for your ribs, which are bamboo, and burned holes in the end of the ribs so you got the curve of the wing for lift. Then you wired that, then covered it with Japanese paper. But the motor on it was a 16-ply of 1-inch square rubber band, you know, back and forth, throughout the fuselage. You had to wind it up by hand, you know, and you let it fly.
So you had a love of aviation and airplanes. And what year was it that you joined the Air Corps, 42?
43, I think.
And so where did you do basic training?
I didn't know what to do with us. And you look at the book there. I have photographs in there of the number of cadets who left Pittsburgh, you know. There's a bunch of us. And they didn't know what to do with us, so they decided to send us to a CTD, College Training Detachment. So they sent us down to Center College in Danville, Kentucky. I really enjoyed that. That was nice. They had Taylor Cubs and Piper Cub airplanes. We got a few hours there flying. But the nice part about it was right across the town was the KCW, Kentucky College for Women. And they would have dances and so on. All chaperoned, of course. And we would be invited over there to spend the evening, you know. But then from there, I was sent to Arkansas. We were sent to Arkansas. And usually they sent you down to South for a while, and you come up north for your next school. But in Arkansas, I went to Camden for the primary flying. And I was flying Stearman's bi-wing aircraft, you know. They were about 150 horsepower or something. So you got through Camden, and then you got your check ride and so on by an Army officer.
And at each stage, people washed out, right?
Oh, yeah.
A lot of washouts.
Yeah, a lot of them. And they could either go to, say, bombardier school or gunnery school if they wanted to stay in the Air Corps. Then from Camden, they shipped us to basic training to Walnut Ridge, Arkansas, about 40 miles. We all figured we were going to go north, you know, get out of Arkansas. We went about 40 miles to Walnut Ridge and flew what we call Volte vibrators. They were about 400 horsepower somewhere there, low-wing metal monoplane. And we got through that basic. Then you decided whether you wanted to be a bomber pilot or a fighter pilot. You could go to single-engine school or twin-engine school. So I thought I wanted to be a dive bomber and light bomber pilot. So I chose a twin-engine school. I never got out of the state of Arkansas. So I got my wings in it.
Why twin engine rather than a fighter?
Well, I just wanted to fly a light bomber like B-25, B-26, something fast, you know. I didn't get it. I went through flying school there and got my wings. And they sent me down to Miami Beach, Florida. And they made up their head, you know, what they were going to do with us down there. I ended up at Chatham Field in Savannah, Georgia. And I assembled a crew there, got a crew of 10 men, and flew a B-24 out of there.
Was that the first time you had seen or flown a B-24? What did you think of it?
Oh, it was like any other airplane, you know. You don't really worry about it because that's your airplane. You learn to fly it best way you can to do it. But once you get it in the air and you learn more about other, like the bombers of B-17, it was better at high altitude, you know. More stable and everything. And we had shortcomings in the B-24. That once we got them in combat, they were changed. For instance, they had an armor plate, like your cockpit seat. The armor plate was like half a bathtub. Went up over top of you, came down around the side. Well, that's all right, you know, to protect you. But when you're being jumped by fighters, you have to look out around it. You'd hear your gunners call the fighter, say there's bogeys at 3 o'clock level. Well, you're looking like this, you know, or bogeys here and bogeys there. And when they got in close enough to see what they were, and they chained them, those are bandits, then you knew they were German fighters. See?
So what's a bogey?
Well, it's an unidentified aircraft. It's one out here that you don't really know what it is, you know, because a ME-109 pretty much looked like a P-51. But then once they got in, either they were bandits or little friends. If there were our fighters, oh, they're little friends, you know.
Did you fly from Savannah across the Atlantic in your B-24?
No, what we did after we formed up, you know, and made night cross countries and long trips and everything, they assigned us to go overseas to combat. But I was told to go stop at Langley Field, Virginia, and if I had any personnel that I couldn't get along with, I could put him in a pool there and pull out another gunner or something, you know.
And did you like your crew, your original crew, or was there a troublemaker in the bunch? Or
I had no trouble with them. I didn't have any problem. I remember landing at Langley Field, Virginia, and I was sitting in the cockpit filling out the form, you know, fill out after every trip. And I heard my crew talking to somebody outside. So when I finished, I dropped down through the Bombay and went out. There was a lieutenant there telling them they had to meet a formation. So I told him, I said, wait a minute. I said, we're a transient crew. I said, we're on our way overseas. We still have to meet a formation. All right. So anyway, I didn't have a necktie. All my clothes and everything were in the waist of the airplane. You know, we're going overseas. Anyway, they call this formation, and we all fell out for the formation. I was standing there, and the head of the formation, more or less, back over, I could hear fallout, you know. My crew, part of my crew. So the next thing, lieutenant comes back to me and tells me to go see the commandant of the field there at a certain time, 3 o'clock or something. So I went in and I saw the commandant. It was Bill Snowden, lieutenant colonel. So he read the riot act to me, you know, telling me I set up a poor model for my crew and so on. No necktie. So anyway, after he was finished calling me down, I saluted him when I was leaving. He said, this won't appear on your 201 file, this administrative reprimand. They call it. So anyway, when I was overseas, and it come time for me to be promoted from a second lieutenant to a first lieutenant, Major Thayer called me in his office. He's our squadron CO. He says, what the hell is this on your record here? And I told him, and he says, oh, Jesus, there's no sense in me putting this through. He says, it'll come back, you know. So I couldn't get promoted there because of the fact that I didn't have a necktie on that time. Stuff like that you put up with, you know. But anyway, the same Bill Snowden, I was finishing up a tour of duty overseas. And who comes over but Bill Snowden? He wasn't in our group, but I would pass him on the field there, you know. And I had to salute him. He was a superior officer. But I ignored him as much as I could, you know. If I see him coming, I'd go the other way. Oh, there's all sorts of things like that. You just live a day at a time in combat.
Did you go overseas from Langley?
From Langley, we went to Dow Field in Bangor, Maine. We were going to lay over there for a while. Then we had a bunch of C-54s coming in behind us, big transport. They were going to England, so they couldn't service all of us. So they kicked us out of there, and we flew to Gander Bay, Newfoundland, landed up there. Now, well, for sure, we'll lay over here tonight because it was getting a little late. C-54s were following us. So they kicked us out of Gander Bay at 11 o'clock at night to fly over the ocean, you know. I never flew over an ocean. I'd never been on an ocean. There's no horizon, no nothing, you know. But we took out of there and flew and had a young engineer, or a young navigator by the name of Ned Ball from Dumont, New Jersey. And you begin to wonder, you know, just how good he is. He's young. So as we approached Logan's Field in the Azores Islands off the coast of Spain, I thought, well, I don't know, sorry, something. Turned the old radio compass, you know, on there, and it swung right. We were right on course, you know.
Isn't that amazing how those navigators can do their work?
Well, they do. When they're flying, like if you try to hit something in the ocean, you don't fly directly to it, because if you miss it one way or another, which way do you turn? So what they do, they fly what they call a landfall. They draw a line through it, and they deliberately correct to one side or the other, so that when their ETA runs out, they know which way to turn, see. Same, we landed in Loggins and laid over there a couple of days, and then moved into Marrakech, French Morocco, North Africa, and that's where we went into combat and chased the German general across North Africa and kicked him out of North Africa. Then invaded Sicily. We supported Sicily.
So you supported the Sicily invasion. That was July 1943.
Then after Sicily, we invaded Italy.
Do you remember your first combat mission?
Oh, I don't remember what date it was.
Do you remember what it was like or what you felt being in combat for the first time?
Well, you're excited. I remember that. We were about 5 or 6 miles inland from the Bay of Manfredonia, where it was nice and level. We had a 6,000 feet of runway, 2,000 feet of steel matting, and 2,000 feet of tamped earth. Another 2,000 feet of steel matting. That was something, getting those heavy ships off there, because we weighed close to 60,000 pounds when we were ready to go, you know, bombs and gas and armor and all this business. You sweat out a takeoff.
Because you're so heavy.
Yeah, well, another thing, it's sort of crosswind, because the winds come in off the Adriatic Sea. They set it up deliberately that way, because in the hot weather, you have this layer of tamped earth, and the dust would settle there. You lose sight of the ship ahead of you. And as soon as he gets halfway down the runway, he passes the control tower. The control tower gives you a green light. So you're sitting there with your throttle shoved all the way forward and locked. All your engines are pulling everything they can pull. Sit there whining in a little bit of supercharger, you know, to gain a little more engine. And finally, you release, touch your toe brakes, and your ship urges forward. You're hoping the guy ahead of you gets off all right. You don't want to hit him from behind. But what they have to do, it's a matter of fuel. The longer you're on the ground, the more fuel you're using. So they try to get you off as fast as they can, get your squadron all formed into a group. There's four squadrons to a group, about 40 aircraft. That was when we were flying. We had 10 ships to a squadron and four squadrons to a group. So that meant 40 airplanes to one group. You know.
40 airplanes in one group on one mission.
Oh, yeah. Well, then that wasn't the only group. There were many groups. There were 1,000 airplanes in the air. I can't imagine what the German civilians imagined when they looked up and saw all those contrails, you know.
Incidentally, the mayor of Turnola was here in Pittsburgh last month, because he was a boy during World War II, a young boy, and he remembers all the airmen giving him cigarettes to give his dad to sell. And
we tried to help them. The Germans, as they moved up through Italy, they really cleaned it up, took everything, you know. And this one kid we had, he would come to the tent. We lived in tents. Four officers lived in the tent. He would come to the tent, and we would give him our clothes for laundry. He would take them, and his mother and sister would do the laundry job, and we'd pay him.
Do you remember your first mission, what it was like, what you felt? Was it, you know, was every mission equally scary, or did you get used to it?
You don't really know. You know, you don't know enough to be scared, really, because you feel, well, I'm going to get up in that airplane. I'm going to be way up here looking down. Nothing bad can happen. Well, it can't. You grow accustomed to it, you know. But it's hard when you're sleeping at night. You come back and you try to lay there and trying to sleep. You figure, well, where are we going tomorrow, you know?
How many missions would you fly in a week? Would it be?
Oh, you flew almost every day.
Almost every day.
When we went over there, 15th Air Force had to fly 50 as a tour of duty. The 8th Air Force only had to fly 25. The 8th Air Force had all the PR men. They had movie stars, Jimmy Stewart, you know, Andy Russell, Clark Gable, and Ed Sullivan, and they had everybody up there, see. And they just had to fly across the channel, you know, and they were in Europe. But we had to fly over every doggone country between us and Germany, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Austria. Every little spot, the Germans had a few flak guns, flat cars on the railroad, you know, or at a regular station. So you got fired at every once in a while on your trip. Then when you got to where your target was, you hit an IP, an initial point. Hit that initial point, and then you turned, picked up your axis of attack, and you flew as a crow fly, straight ahead, no matter what. And, of course, that didn't last but a few minutes. But then your fighters all left you. They didn't want to get in that. So they could run from the flak. You know, we couldn't. We had to get through it. Pieces of steel flying around, you know. Yeah, that's what you fly right through. So you're going to get hit. It's like me telling you to run across the street, you know, and I have a handful of gravel and I throw it. You're going to get hit. Maybe not bad, but you'll be hit. Like I said before, the service ceiling of the B-24 was like 26,000, 28,000 feet, depending on the air, the temperatures and so on. And those 88-millimeter shells, they could set the fuse for altitude. They picked us up with radar. They knew what our altitude was, so we couldn't fool them any. We just went right in, and by the time we got there, that hole was acres of flak out there. I heard it rumored that Germans tried to set up 2,000 yards of flak in a square over a target.
I've read that they would pick out the B-24s. I guess this is more German fighters would prefer to hit the B-24s rather than the B-17 because the 24s went down easier.
Well, I don't know whether we had the same armament. We had 10-50 caliber guns, nose turret, top turret, belly turret, tail turret, and two waist windows, you know. And then toward the end there, the Germans were losing their fighter pilots too. We were getting a bunch of their fighter pilots. By the time that ME-262, the first jet aircraft, come to be, most of their pilots were gone, you know. Young fellows were flying them. When the Tuskegee Airmen attacked them, they didn't have to worry too much about jet attacks because the jets were so fast, but they weren't very maneuverable. Where the P-51, you could turn it on a dime, you know, flip around. And the Tuskegee Airmen were good flyers once they were airborne. It was rumored that their depth perception as a race isn't as good as a white man's, you know. And that's important when you're trying to land an airplane. But once they got in the air, they have a natural rhythm or something, you know, that they're good flyers.
Do you remember seeing Tuskegee Airmen for the first time arrive? Or did you know anything about them? Or
No, we just understood from briefing, you know. We were all briefed before a mission. We went into what was one time a wine cellar was below ground, and then they briefed us on the weather and on this, that, and everything they could, you know. And they would tell us who were going to escort us. I don't remember what they would escort us on our first mission or the fifth mission, you know. But and we were escorted by a number of white pilots, too.
I did an interview with Ed Ryan, the builder, the home builder, and he was a navigator on a B-24, but he has the same story. I smiled when you said we went down in the wine cellar to get briefed. He told me the same thing. Down. He knew how many steps. He remembered how many steps it was.
Then they had what we sit on was planks. They had the planks off the floor by cinder block. Cinder block piled up, you know, and planks stretching across. That's what we sat on to be briefed.
Do you remember any grumbling by some white pilots or white crew about having these black pilots escort you, or no? Nothing you could remember?
No, in Cherignola there, we'd go in there, you know, and we'd pass Tuskegee Airmen there. They were always well-dressed. They were very proud of their uniform. They were spit and polish, you know. They were interested in maintaining a good look, you know. But and there were times, I guess, where he tried to get their hair cut, couldn't get a haircut because of a white barber. Till the CO come along, told the barber, "You cut anybody's hair that comes in here." Things like that. They had to constantly put up with that sort of thing.
And do you remember any particular mission where the Tuskegee Airmen helped you particularly much, or?
I tell you, things happen so fast up there in the air. You got fighters flying, you know, in and around and attacking you and everything. You're trying to avoid other bombers that were hit and veer, you know. So your mind's so occupied, you don't pick planes out. You see a red tail go by once in a while, you know, and you see one that isn't a red tail. And a German Messerschmitt goes by. And
You said you were hit a couple times by flak. Your ship was hit. Could you tell me what happened?
Your ship gets holes punched in it every time you go out, you know. Then you come back and your crew chief takes over and repairs it. And while they're doing that, you slow time another airplane. When they make an engine change in a bomber, they like to put 25 hours of slow time on it to get that engine working, you know. So if you're not flying missions, you're slow timing aircraft. So you're in the air all the time. It's just like second nature after a while. I flew three missions that where they were called Plan Abel, Plan Baker, and Plan George. They were pretty secret. But what they do, we use a Mickey ship, what they call a Mickey ship. It's a Liberator that's completely equipped with radar. You have what they call a Bombigator, who can navigate by radar and bombs by radar. So they pick a bad night, raining and miserable, and they send out one Liberator by yourself. And on it is an OSS man. What you have to do is drop this OSS man a certain spot into what's supposedly sympathizers on the ground. They're spies. My hat's off to those guys. Oh, jeez.
So you'd flew some of those, huh? Some of those guys. You dropped some of those guys in.
Yeah, we dropped them twice, and we bombed once. But my hat was off to those OSS men. We had like a settee like this, only it was leather and didn't have the back on it behind the cockpit. And they would come up, get on the airplane, and sit down there the whole trip. Then the bombardier would light a little light in the bomb bay to tell them, get ready, you know. They were going to open up the bomb bay doors, and he had to step out into the night. That's what I say, my hat was off to those guys. And they were over enemy territory, hoping that somebody on the ground was going to meet them.
How long would your missions last? 8 hours, 5 hours on average?
They varied. You'll see in the book there at the... has all my missions listed and the time and so on, you know. Time you're in the air.
How long would you be in the air?
Oh, in the average, we 5 or 6 hours, I guess. Depending on where you went now. We went all the way into Germany, into Buckhammer, and after we destroyed the oil fields for them in Ploesti, they started to make synthetic oil at Buckhammer, Germany, and Odertal, Germany. They had these big synthetic oil plants. So we had to get rid of them. So we'd fly all the way from Italy into Germany and back, you know. That was pretty long.
That's a long haul.
Yeah, a good part of the day.
So when you came back from a mission, I mean, the missions are so intense. You have to concentrate so hard. When you come back, you must be just wiped out, exhausted.
Well, you're weary, you know, but G2 questions you. See, yeah, you got to be debriefed by G2. So you go through all that, you know.
When you land, do you get a shot of whiskey and a donut? Or...
Yeah, the Red Cross and all was there. And you could have a drink of whiskey, you know, and a donut if you wanted.
And then G2 would debrief you. And then eventually you'd head back to your tent and think, well, I'm going to do this tomorrow again.
Yeah, try to go to sleep.
Your ship was hit particularly hard, at least one mission, right?
I was hit twice with flak, shrapnel. That 80-millimeter shell comes up and explodes at altitude. That's set on a fuse in the nose of the shell. Gets to a certain altitude, bam. And then go off right back and hit the ship. The shrapnel flies all over. Sky's filled with steel flying around. Tears up your airplane, you know. The one time I had a piece come up through the floor of the ship, and something hit me in the chest, you know, whap. Just like somebody hit me with the edge of a book, and I couldn't hear. I thought I was deaf. It's funny how your mind works, you know, because all that static and the talk on my headset was off. So I thought, oh, God, I'm deaf. I was afraid to look down. I could see blood all over the place, you know. And finally it dawned on me, hey, you can hear those engines running. You're not deaf. So I finally looked down. Here the cord from the headset was nipped against the flak seal, you know, of my flak vest. Just nipped that cord.
How many missions did you end up flying?
51.
50? Why 51?
Well, there was one that the crew kind of gets attached to a pilot, you know. And they feel better, I guess, with them or something. There was some of those missions so bad that they give us double sortie credit. So when you say 51 missions, you're talking 51 sorties. So I really didn't have... 51 times over a target was something like 47. You can look at that record, you can see. Because some of them were so bad in our losses and so on that they give us a double sortie credit. So you end up with 51, you know. But now your crew gets accustomed to you and you get accustomed to the crew, you know. You don't like to have a stranger on board and they don't like to have a stranger flying the airplane either.
Did all your crew make it?
Well, no. Ned Paul and Larry Bruni went down, not with us. They were down with another crew, you know. They were filling in.
And you were on stand down, and they filled in?
They filled in as a stand down. The crew needed a bombardier and a navigator, you know.
And what happened to them?
They got shot down. And Bruni didn't get out. He must have been hit in the aircraft. Ned bailed out, you know. And then he was a POW for a short time. And you'll see pictures there of George McGovern. He come over. I was right as I finished on my tour of duty, they changed the number of missions you had to fly to 35. They increased the ones in England to 35 because they only had to fly 25. But anyway, when George McGovern come over, he got there when he only had to fly 35. So I got to know him fairly well, you know. Because we'd come home off a mission and those young pilots would be at the mess table there. And they'd be all ears. We'd be talking about the flak and the fighters and so on. Boy, they'd be listening and trying to hear the best they could, you know. So I got to know him pretty well then.
What was he like?
Oh, he was a good fellow. His father was a minister out there in Dakota, you know. Yeah, he was there to do a job.
What tips would you have given a younger pilot or a newer pilot?
Well, if they would have asked, you know, you try to straighten them out. Then we had fellows, we had one, I can remember, he was Cherokee Indian, and he was a pilot. I think he named his ship Teepee Time Gal or something. But anyway, he was going to go on a mission, even out the aircraft, and I don't know whether it was a crew chief or one of the other one was singing the song, something, "This Is My Last Affair." He wouldn't fly that mission. He says, "I'm not flying that mission," because he figured that put a blast on the ship. Yeah, he was superstitious. He was a good guy, you know.
Were you at all superstitious? I've heard that most crewmen were, had some kind of ritual or superstition that they were.
The only thing I carried was a little New Testament. Took it on every mission I flew. The church gave it to me when I left to go into service. I give it to everybody. And I would slip that in my flying suit pocket, and I figure, well, if I get shot down, I'll have something to read, you know. I don't think they'll take it from me. Who knew, you know? But that made every trip with me.
What else did you carry with you on a trip? I mean, what did you have in case you were shot down?
Well, there's no sense in carrying anything, really, because they'd take it off of you, you know, as soon as you landed. You lost it.
So you didn't carry a sidearm with you?
Well, we had, the officers had a 45, you know, but that's the only thing. You had nothing, no money or anything in your...
No chocolate bars, no...
No, because once you got to altitude, you had a face mask. You couldn't eat anything, you know, till you got back. So there was no sense in carrying that kind of thing. Then you didn't want anything that weighed anything. You had to carry the 45, supposedly, you know. We embalmed Athens, Greece. Yeah, when the Russians were moving in, you know, they figured Greece was going to be taken by the Russians. The Germans tried to get their troops out of there. So they were at the airport. They flew in ships, transports, to take them out. And I'll never forget that. I hated that. But we bombed that with anti-personnel bombs, little bombs that dropped down like confetti. They went off and steel went around. We killed so damn many of those. You know, there's young soldiers and all. That didn't appeal to me. When the Russians were coming in from the east, you know, they were going to cut the Germans off. So the Germans tried to get their troops out back to Germany. They had them all in trucks and vans and everything at this airport, and we hit the airport. And a personnel. Little bombs are made like hand grenades, only they're in bundles. About that big around on the bomb rack. And there are a whole bunch of them, you know. They're on a pylon. As soon as they get down, the pie pan on the front falls off. I always call them a pie pan, holding them together, you know. And there's a long boat-like with a propeller on it. And as soon as they get on, that propeller unwinds it, and they just fall apart. They get on like confetti. You see, at altitude, most of our crewmen, we only had two men who weren't in a turret. They were waist gunners. But the top turret man, he was protected by the turret around, you know. And the bottom turret, the ball turret, tail turret, and nose turret, they were all metal and glass, heavy glass and so on. And so they were in pretty good shape. But that ball turret guy, he couldn't get out by himself. He had to have help getting the ball turret up from the bottom once it was down. It was a B-17 pilot. It was over Germany. The ship got hit. And the pilot told them to bail out, you know. So they did. The ball gunner cried to the pilot that he couldn't get out. Nobody to raise his ball turret up, you know, to the flight deck. So the pilot said, we'll take this ride together. And he did. But he said, you know, the young fellow in the ball, he was scared and yelled. And he just told me, we'll take this ride together. Well, that's the way you sort of feel about it, you know. That crew means like a family to you, you know. You're close. We had pilots that just sort of broke down, you know. They just couldn't take it anymore, just refused to fly, that's all. So they sent them someplace, I don't know, some kind of hospital. And you're always figuring, you know, we lay down there at night, you're always figuring, geez, law of average, you got to catch up with me. You know, I've been so damn lucky, because as these missions go, and they're so bad, you get through a flak field, and you go, gee, I'm blessed, you know. But when you're laying there at night thinking, you don't know what the target is, it may be a really bad one, think, well, law of average is going to catch up to me this time. But it doesn't. So then you figure, geez, you know, maybe next time. But you keep telling yourself, you know, you can't win them all, because you don't expect to. You expect to die, and you don't.
Do you remember what it felt like, your final mission, to finally have flown your last mission? And did you know that this was going to be your last?
Yeah, you're always figuring, you know, every night you lay down to sleep, you lay in there in the cot, you wonder, well, I wonder where we go tomorrow, you know. I bet the law of average catches up with me, because you don't figure you're going to live through them all. And you figure, well, I wonder if it's tomorrow. Maybe not. You're sitting there arguing back and forth, you know. But you always figure that the law of averages has to catch up to you.
And it never did.
No, you lucked it out.
It's hard for me to imagine the rest of your life to come that close, have that many chances of being killed, but you weren't.
You face death 50 times, that's all. Every day you go out, you face death. So you luck it out and live through 50 missions, and that's it.
Do you think it made you more grateful for throughout the rest of your life? Or?
Oh, I feel I've been blessed all my life, you know. I don't know. I can't figure out what's causing all this today's army and soldiers and so on. They're coming back with this PTSD, or their brains are all fouled up and everything. God, they've all got mental problems. They're really not fighting that much. You know, what you read about in the magazines and the papers and so on, the kind of fighting they're doing over there, like when the Fifth Army was moving up through Italy, those guys were laying in foxholes. Their feet were frozen, their hands were frozen, mud, you know. And just day after day, they couldn't do anything about it. But none of them went goofy, or you didn't read anything about, you know, them having these mental breakdowns and all this stuff of what they're doing for these veterans. But those guys over there, they don't have the mud and the cold and all that the Fifth Army had, so I don't know. And then too, it's sort of open fighting over there, you know. They see you ahead of them a group of guys, and uh-oh. So they take a shot at them, that sets it off. So then there's a fight, you know. But now, like they flew into Somalia there, and flew in with helicopters, got that man and woman out of there. That would never happen in Germany. But I mean, it's just a different war, and I can't understand why these guys are coming back so damn badly shot. And I don't know of one guy that flew with us, you know, had any of that problem. They were glad to get to Fort Dix. When I come home, I was home 1 week and I went back to work where I left the job, you know.
You went to the same place?
Yeah, Scaife Company.
1 week?
In 1 week I was back to work and I'd got all the raises that they give while I was in the service. You know, as they raised money for the employees, I got them all. I kept my salary balance. It's just, I started where I left off. Yeah, I was a product engineer. I was head of the product engineering department.
And how did it work when you flew your last mission? How much longer did you stay in Italy after that? Until the end of the war?
Oh, no. No, I finished up my tour of duty on November 4th, I think, 1944. War was over for me, you know. Then it was a matter of flying a war-weary airplane home, a B-24 home, or taking a ship home. And I wish I'd have flew a war-weary airplane home, because we went over to Naples, and we got on a ship. It was a hospital ship, a big ship. We were part of a convoy, you know. So we started out through the doggone Mediterranean Sea, and I thought, man, this isn't bad at all, you know, really nice, smooth. Then we went through the Strait of Gibraltar, and we hit the North Atlantic in November. Oh, my God. Wasn't very long before I was laying in the cot, had a hold of two pipes up here, and my toes wrapped around the ones at the bottom. That ship would yaw, you know, and pitch and yaw, and it never stops, you know. Just, oh, God, I couldn't. Then we were heading for the East Coast, of course. Then we go in sight of the East Coast, and what do they do? I was ready to swim to the coast. They start up along the coast till we get to New York. Yeah, I'll never forget that. Doggone boats.
Did you see the Statue of Liberty or anything like that?
Yeah.
Did you have any special feeling when you saw that?
I can't remember whether it was special or not, but I was glad to see it, you know. I was glad to get off the boat. Then there was still submarines, German U-boat. So every once in a while you'd see a destroyer go racing through the convoy, you know, back or forth, looking for U-boats. That scared you. Because what the hell are you going to do if you get torpedoed out of here? Can't swim to America.
Why did you choose the slow boat rather than the airplane? Because it...
Well, those airplanes were war-weary. They had been shot at and fixed and shot at and fixed.
So you didn't quite trust it, huh?
No, you just didn't trust one to get you all the way home. But my dear girl had waited on me because we were friends before I went into the service. And she waited, and so we got married, went up to Katanning, PA, and a judge married us. We didn't have a big wedding or anything. I was just glad to be back, and she was glad to have me back. And
how soon after getting back did you get married?
Oh, I got back in 45, and we were married in 46. I finished up in 45, you know, November. So it was the first part of 46 that we got married. And she lasted until 1985. She died. And I met a fellow friend of mine, Rick Glantz. He has an architectural business over here in Roslyn Farms. And his mother, she had a real deal. She got married to a fellow who worked at one of the newspapers in Pittsburgh. I don't know what it was. But when Rick was only 5 years old, he walked out on him with a woman from the office and went into the Carolinas. She had to cut it herself. He never sent a penny home for child support, her husband, or he took half the money that they had saved when they both worked after they were married. She got a job with Fort Pitt, or Bell Telephone, rather, and worked 33 years there. She got Rick through Canavan High School, then into Kent College out in Ohio, where he graduated as an architect. So he went to work for an architectural firm for a couple years, and that didn't appeal to him, so he decided he would go into business for himself. Well, they had a nice home there in Roslyn Farms, and the attic was a large, spacious place. You know, I'd just start my own company. So I got a couple guys lined up, and he put his office in the third floor of the house, and he did well, you know. Started doing a lot of work for Catholic churches. And right now he has an apartment on Fifth Avenue in New York. He has a cottage on the seashore up in Nova Scotia. So he and his wife Karen go up to Nova Scotia for the warmer weather, nice weather. And they come back to New York for the cold weather. And he calls me every week, calls me every Sunday usually. and just to check on my well-being and so on. But I met his mother, and she had cancer, breast cancer. And my wife had died, you know, with damn cancer, and I just couldn't turn my back on her. I thought, well, I'll do what I can for her, being that she's Rick's mother. And I did. We had a nice relationship, you know, nothing intimate, just I tried to have some joy for her. And she had 4 cancer operations, and she died of leukemia, you know. But Rick never forgot that, because he was trying to put a company together. And I took that load off his shoulders, you know. And I took her places and did things. We went to the Mardi Gras, and I took her to California to visit a friend of hers, and we went down into Tijuana, Mexico. She enjoyed that. Then when her grandson, Jonathan, graduated from Kent behind his father, as a gift, we took him to Europe. And over there, we journeyed around Europe, and I saw some of the cities we had bombed, you know, how well it was repaired and all. And eventually she passed away, but Rick's never forgot me. He considered me one of the family. No, I was reading the newspaper one day. I got the newspaper in the morning and said that Joe Hardy was going to have a get-together at World War II veterans in Uniontown. George McGovern was going to be the keynote speaker. So I said to Elizabeth Glantz, so I never told her that I knew George McGovern. So anyway, I asked her, I said, we'll get down to that. And I took the book Wild Blue with me, but he made his speech, you know. He came down, he was talking to a couple men. So I handed her the book and I said, here, honey, take that over, see if you'll autograph it. She is very sociable. So she went over, and pretty soon there's talking back and forth, back and forth. She's giving me this, come over, you know. So I started to amble over, and I got about as far as from George about to Rich there. And he grabbed me in a big bear hug, you know. And she's standing there. She thought he attacked me. I didn't tell her I knew him.
Oh, great. Oh, great.
Never forget the look on her face.
You still have your uniform, huh?
No, I don't have. I lost it in a fire. We went in the house when we were first married, and everything we had was there. And then my brother-in-law built a home right out of Freeport. And then he worked for the gas company here in Pittsburgh, and he decided not to move up there. So I told him I'll buy it. It was nice when I saw him. So I bought it and raised my family there. And right after we moved up there, it was near Christmas. And my wife woke me one night and said, Jim, she says, what's that light? So I went to the bedroom window and I looked out, and you could see down, the house was down along the river. There's a good bit of light down there. So I thought, uh-oh. So I put some clothes on, jumped the car, run down. The fire chief was there. He says, God, am I glad to see you, Jim. He said, I thought you were in there. That place was all place. It was a place we rented. It belonged to somebody else. But they figured a hobo on the railroad, you know, went in there and lit a fire, didn't pay any attention to it, and caught fire. But I lost my uniforms and other things. But what we were doing when we moved, we had the 2 little girls. All we were thinking about was Christmas, you know, coming. So I moved Christmas stuff, but I didn't think about uniforms or anything.
Yeah.